is going to be sustainability in architecture. Buildings are one of the biggest users of energy, and we're going to talk about what we can do to be sure that our buildings don't use up too many of the resources of our finite globe. So, Dan, go ahead.
I think we discussed starting with a brief definition of sustainability, and you know, it really can be applied to not only buildings, but really anything that's built by human hands. And, you know, at best, sustainability should be building things, creating things in a way that can be looped sort of infinitely. And, you know, the way we currently use our resources, you know, that's not true. As an example, a lot of items that are recycled are what's referred to as downcycled. So, for instance, an aluminum can, a lot of times those cannot be infinitely recycled into more aluminum cans because they're contaminated with the paint that's on them, etc., or other items that get mixed in and different alloys get mixed in. The resulting recycled product is inferior to the one that preceded it. And the same thing, you know, sort of applies to buildings. At this point, I think in the stage of sustainability, we're in the mode of making things better than what they are currently, but not quite yet to the point where we can make a building able to be taken apart and reused sort of infinitely.
And I think that's an interesting point, because the way we're using energy right now, it's not sustainable. If you think of the word sustain, it means you're able to maintain sort of a constant level where the kind of the energy going in and the energy coming out somehow balance. Sure. at a global level. And right now that we put a lot more energy into buildings specifically than a lot of other things, and it's depleting resources at a surprising rate.
Sure, buildings are responsible for 40% of the energy usage in the U.S., so it's a pretty high percentage.
Yeah, and I think I saw recently that if you portion that out to just electrical, it's almost 67%, if I remember right, of just electrical usage goes into buildings.
It's likely true. The next portion of the topic that we were going to talk about was the impact of this concept of sustainability on Chicago. Mayor Daley is an outspoken celebrator of sustainability, and he has the lofty goal of making Chicago the greenest city in the world, which is probably a little bit of a stretch due to the enormous lead that the European nations and European cities have on us. But I think certainly the greenest city in the United States is an attainable goal without actually trying to do too much.
Yeah, and the difference in construction between Europe and the United States is interesting there, because there seems to be an understanding that buildings are intended to last a very long time. There's a different idea of the life cycle of buildings, and therefore they put a lot more initial cost into making high-quality buildings at the onset, and that includes how they use energy as the building ages.
And I think that also has a lot to do with land value in Europe. You know, the land scarcity in Europe forces that to some degree, I think, also. But at any rate, in relation to sustainability in Chicago, Daley has sort of two side-by-side programs, one called the Chicago Standard, and then another, I'm not sure if he has a name for it, but it's basically a parallel permitting structure so that buildings which normally couldn't get a permit in Chicago because of some of their advanced sustainability concepts or strategies used in them can go through sort of an alternate permit process. But the Chicago Standard is basically based on a program called LEED, which is basically a way to measure how green, how sustainable a building is. It's kind of a scorecard for buildings.
And LEED stands for
Leadership in Energy and Environmental Design.
Yeah. I always forget that one.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure that's what it means. At any rate, the Chicago Standard is sort of a watered-down version of LEED, specifically geared, I think, toward the development community in Chicago and institutional community in Chicago, showing, well, you know, if you're scared off by LEED, here are things that you could easily apply in Chicago. You know, another component of Daley's greening of Chicago is the Green Roof Program. I guess it's really part of the Chicago Standard or initiative, but There's, you know, and Kevin, you probably know more about this than me. There are bonuses given for FAR, floor area ratio, so that you can build more building if you're putting in a green roof on your building in Chicago. So it's sort of their way of trying to pay people back for undergoing the cost of a green roof, which, you know, is significant. It's not one of, the green roof is really one of the least economical sustainable strategies.
So. No, especially it takes a lot of attention to the plants that you are putting in on your roof. One of the great things about the green roof is it absorbs rainwater instead of running it off, so it holds water and lets it into the system more slowly, and it absorbs and processes energy instead of reflecting it back up into the sky, increasing the sort of heat island effect as well. But back to LEEDs a little bit, is LEED is really a system that's in place to measure how green or how environmentally friendly a building is, not just in construction, but in terms of its energy usage during the life of the building, and its how friendly it is to occupy, whether or not there are potential harmful gases that can escape from materials in the building, and increasing the quality of the environment for the person inside of it, as well as thinking about the energy usage of the building and the damaging environmental effects in the construction.
Yeah, absolutely. One of the strengths of LEED is that it's multidimensional. So it considers sustainability not necessarily just, as you said, not just necessarily an energy consumption issue or recycled materials. It's looking at a lot of different things, from how you site a building, what you do on site, how you use water in the building, how you use energy, how you're treating the people within your building in terms of exposing them to harmful, potentially toxic material,
and that's,
or light and you know, yeah, lighting quality in the building, etc. So I think that's really one of the strengths, and you know, one of the other strengths of it is their goal was transforming the building industry, and to a large extent, I think in architecture they've really achieved that. They've taken a subject that was really peripheral, and it has become really a buzzword in architecture, and almost every architecture firm of various sizes are having to deal with it, and they're getting people LEED accredited and familiar with the program and with the concepts of sustainability. From a large company like OWP&P or Perkins & Will, who both have aggressive programs on getting a lot of people LEED accredited, to, you know, even smaller firms, they kind of know that it's something that's coming. It's something that institutions and clients are interested in, have heard about. As a result, with architects asking the sort of questions now that they do based on the LEED program, the building products industry, like the carpet manufacturers and the paint manufacturers, are responding by taking another look at their process of how they make what they make.
So one thing about the LEED process is that a lot of government agencies are also beginning to require it. So it's beginning to be legislated that buildings in certain municipalities, and even the GSA, the General Services Administration, is going to require all of their buildings to attempt a LEED silver certification, because LEED also kind of ranks the buildings depending on how many points you receive. So that's one thing that's also becoming significant to architects, is that we're going to have to know about it in order to get work. And I think that's actually a very good move in a lot of ways, because it just forces the issue, and a lot of times that needs to happen with sustainability.
I think one of the things that architects struggle with, because I perceive them as being kind of ahead of the curve on sustainability and LEED at this point, because it's become so big within the industry, is they are really hamstrung by what's available, and also by, you know, sometimes contractors' willingness to do things, or subcontractors', you know, ignorance of how to do something. And, you know, some of the people are interested in learning something new, and some people really kind of fight it. But in terms of building products, I think things are changing around. But still, you know, you find it pretty difficult to get products that don't have some negative thing about them. You know, maybe they have low volatile organic compound content in them, so they're not off-gassing toxins, but, you know, they don't use any recycled material. It's all, you know, virgin material or something. So there's always kind of pros and cons to the things that architects end up having to decide.
And that's one thing that we need to be careful of and is very difficult to try and judge, is that if there's a particular product and half of that product is sustainable, no matter how you make the product, that companies are starting to just appear and say, hey, look, you know, we do this to make our product more green, but they've always done that anyway, and so there's really no difference.
Yes, that's absolutely true, that you got to be careful of kind of greenwashing, which is people just highlight, like you said, one aspect of their product that, you know, has a green storyline to it, but everything else is awful about it. I've sat through many presentations of materials like that. But, you know, it's incumbent upon the architect to do their homework to figure out the full story. And, maybe it's worth also talking about that sort of aspects of products, you know, the different dimensions within. We talked about the dimensions within LEED of how things can be, how LEED rates buildings multidimensionally. Well, within products, you know, there are lots of different things that can be green about a product. As we discussed before, there's low VOC content, which has to do with, you know, toxins that are released or off-gassed by products. There's the content of recycled material within the product. There's how durable the product is. If you have something like terrazzo, even though it's mined material primarily and doesn't have a great deal of recycled content in it, it lasts almost literally forever. So it's, you know, worth considering despite the fact that there's, you know, it's not necessarily, doesn't have any recycled content.
Right, and that's one of the places where you have to kind of wind through different things, is looking at the sort of life cycle of the material. From, you know, anything that's mined is generally not sustainable and non-renewable, in that it's something that once the mine or whatever, and this includes any kinds of stone products as well, is gone, that product doesn't exist anymore. So, however, something like terrazzo, the chips that are involved in it are so plentiful, you have to wonder, I mean, are you ever going to run out of chips of granite to put in, or marble
right.
to put in terrazzo? You know, it's not going to happen. And, you know, terrazzo is also very inert, so it gains points there. And that leads to another kind of problem with LEED that I don't know that there's any way around, and that's the tendency to try and game it. You know, you need X number of points, and you know there's certain things you have points for already, and then you kind of go that far to get the points, and you kind of do little tricks to get the points that may not do as much as they're intended either.
I think that's a totally valid point. And the other sort of con that's related to it with LEED that I would perceive is that there are points that are given for certain things that are just kind of dumb or shouldn't add up to a point in comparison to things like the energy efficiency points. Now, the energy efficiency points are sort of double points, but it's still, in my opinion, a way bigger deal than, for instance, having refueling stations for an electric car. Electric cars are basically technology that isn't being used at this point. And furthermore, all of the systems for refueling electric cars are proprietary. So the refueling station for a Toyota is different than a Honda. So it's not as if you can just put one in and everyone who had an electric car, of which there are so few users, would get it. But you get a LEED point by putting it in, and it's a relatively cheap LEED point, whereas, you know, making your building 5 or 10% more energy efficient is something that's going to impact that building for decades. And it seems like there's a little... as you said, there's ability to sort of game it. You buy points, like, by doing that, or, you know, you get a point for agreeing to purchase X amount of green power. You know, that is a point that you can just buy, but it really is meaningless. You know, in a lot of ways, you're just purchasing the premium that it takes someone to make electricity from a windmill.
And, right, and different ways of making energy are more efficient than others as well.
And
so
it also has nothing to do with, really, with how your building functions or how you were able to, the good things you were able to do in your building. It's literally just buying a point. So I find those things to be, at least there's a way to look at those that's cynical.
And points that are ones you get sort of by default just because you happen to be in a certain area.
Oh, that's true.
Such as within range of two modes of public transportation. It's hard to build a building in the Chicago area without being within two modes.
But I do think those are actually, I would argue,
I think they're very valuable.
They're
yeah.
very valuable points because, I think what you're probably getting at is that most people aren't going to make their siting decision based on those couple of points.
Yeah,
they're
for example,
going to make their decision based on other economic
land availability.
Right.
Their campus just happens to be where their college campus is.
Right. So,
like
it, you know, they're valid points, but yeah, I agree with you. There's really, I think the intent was to influence the siting decision, and it's kind of naive to think that you're going to influence a siting decision based on a point or two for lead. It's just not going to happen. I mean, the project I'm working on is a perfect example. The Kresge Foundation did look at sites in Detroit, but you know, despite the fact that they were going to miss out on a couple of lead points, they decided to stay in their current location for, you know, a whole host of reasons, a lot of which were valid, but you know, it just wasn't enough to swing their decision, even though they're potentially a LEED Platinum building, so they were really trying to accumulate all the points that they could.
Platinum would be a pretty high achievement. It's actually very difficult to get a Platinum building in a harsh environment. What I've seen is most of the buildings I've seen get Platinum are in warm weather, California-type locations where they don't have to put air conditioning in because they're on the coast and they can just open the windows and things like that.
So. Right. Well, that there were... the Kresge Foundation, it's worth talking about this because, you know, if you're out there considering to do a LEED building, the Kresge Foundation is one potential source of grant money. They give money to non-for-profits, primarily, well, I don't know if it's primarily, but a lot of the money that goes to it is goes to colleges that are doing building programs, and they'll give matching grants, so if you raise X amount of money, they'll match that for your building project.
And that's actually really another big bonus of LEEDs as well, is because there are grants and things available out there, mm-hmm. but without a way to quantify whether you qualify or not, they become sort of irrelevant.
And it really varies state by state what sort of things that you're able to get in terms of grants, etc. Kresge also gives extra money for people that are considering to do are considering sustainable strategies. So they'll give you kind of some money to investigate whether or not you can afford or it's the right thing to do in your project, and then they'll give you extra money to actually build those strategies. But, you know, obviously because they're the kind of organization that they are, they were interested in spending some money on sustainability. Right. And so, you know, the cost of LEED has basically been, from what I've heard, in rough terms, it's more or less free if you're doing it early on to get bronze rating in LEED. If you're doing silver, it's at a premium of $5 per square foot. If you're doing gold, it's $10 a square foot, and platinum, kind of, who knows. For the Kresge Foundation project, their goal was gold, and they did agree to do some strategies that did not have economic payback. You know, surprisingly, a high number of the strategies really pay for themselves within a short term. So, you know, for instance, daylight harvesting and the controls, additional controls associated with measuring light levels and dimming lights, etc., payback within 3 to 5 years. So they're really kind of, you know, if you are an owner that's going to own the building for 5 years, it's dumb not to do those things. It's kind of a slam dunk, something you should do regardless of whether you're doing LEED or, you know, just being a good business person.
And, you know, when you start talking about cost per square foot, that always is what the owner of the building, the person who's actually, you know, footing the bill, is extremely interested in. And different clients will have a different tolerance for what they're willing to spend for a green building. And that's one nice thing about the LEED system, is it allows the different levels, and clients can, you know, go for their platinum, or they can, you know, be happy with silver. So,
going back to sort of the economics point, and I think we'll continue to see high energy prices, and, you know, who knows really where that's going. And that totally changes the, you know, economics of doing a green building. What maybe didn't seem like it was going to have payback, for instance, geothermal energy in an environment like ours, a temperate environment like ours, where there's swings of cold and hot, geothermal is a potential way to use the local environment. And the idea with geothermal is that in the summer, you're using the earth, because it's a constant temperature, you're using it as a heat sink, and you're using it as a heat source in winter. And it's kind of an expensive technology. It doesn't, basically, it has about a 20-year life, at least all of the equipment that runs the geothermal, and that's about the payback period. So basically, you're not really gaining any economic benefit out of it. However, that equation is completely upset if gas prices and natural gas prices are 30, 40, 50% higher, or even really where they are.
Which is foreseeable. I know in my condominium, the heating bills tripled in the last 5 years, and I'm sure it'll continue to escalate like that as energy continues to be a global problem.
I guess the next thing that we were going to talk about was, again, where do you go from LEED? Because LEED is all well and good, but to kind of touch back to the beginning, it's really a program about efficiency and doing better than we're currently doing. But just getting there is really eventually not going to be far enough. Eventually we have to figure out ways to, as I put it before, be part of an infinite loop, where we can replicate things over and over again. And, I think it's worth talking about another architect, Bill McDonough, who owns a company with a chemist. And they wrote a book called Cradle to Cradle, which is basically on that point that, eco-efficiency is a worthwhile thing, but let's not kid ourselves that it's really far enough. So, they've been involved in a number of projects, and obviously they can do it because one of the main guys on board is a chemist. Most architects don't have the opportunity to actually develop products as they're building a building. But for instance, the book is made surprisingly not out of paper, and they did that, I think, mostly to prove a point, and that was they made it out of a material that is basically kind of plastic. And the plastic is intended to not be degraded upon using it. They're not totally there yet, and they admit that in their book.
So it's a truly sustainable material in that it can be sort of infinitely recycled.
Right, and what he talks about is that there are two kinds of nutrients. There are biological nutrients and technical nutrients. And biological nutrients are things that are part of the biological process. So, paper, food, anything that could really be composted and then used by the earth in a biological process. And then there are technical things, which not in any sort of useful human time scale, could be broken down by biological processes. So those are things like plastics and metals. And, the idea is really to make products. I think the crux of his idea is that we need to make products so they're able to be taken apart. So instead of something like shoes that has rubber or plastic in them plus leather, which is a natural product, but that leather's been tanned with chromium, which is a toxic material. Shoes should be constructed in a way that the sole, which is bottom of the shoe that's getting abraded by walking around, is made out of some sort of biological material. Maybe it's some sort of form of cornstarch or whatever that gets abraded, and you can take that thing off, and if it's made with leather, you can take that off and shred that stuff and compost it. And then there are components of it that are technical nutrients that can be pulled out and recycled sort of infinitely. But the problem is a lot of products we have, a perfect example is, a circuit board in a computer. It's like, how do you ever take those things apart to recycle them in any sensible or renewable way? You can salvage things out of a computer, like the metals that they use, but they're all so infused together that it makes taking them apart basically impossible.
And even the processes that involve pulling those materials apart are often toxic in and of themselves and require toxic right. chemicals and everything else. I think that idea that there is no landfill, you know, is sort of a global goal. Right now it probably seems like we can just keep throwing things away because there's always someplace farther out in the country where they can make a new little mountain of trash. But that's only going to be doable for a certain amount of time. And, you know, at that point, it really becomes critical. And knowing that we're working towards preventing that now is important. It's the notion of the finite system.
Well, and you know, he makes the point in the book, and that I agree with, is that it's really kind of such a stupid process that we're taking things that cost money to develop, like you know, again, let's say some sort of plastic, that you know, we put a bunch of energy into it, which costs money. We put in extraction into the oil that produces the plastic, and we're paying the people to engineer it and the machines that made it. We're pouring all these resources into it, and then we're just chucking it away because we didn't figure out a way to be able, before we designed the product, to be able to separate it back out. So there are these, you know, landfills are literally filled with treasure that's just being abandoned at this point. Because, you know, we probably should have figured out a way to make things a little smarter.
And that's sort of the point that it seems sort of humanity has been at for a good part of the 20th century, is that resources appear infinite and that we can just kind of continue to use and use and use. And you know, towards the later half of last century, we've realized that that's not the case. And how we as a sort of global people decide to move on from there is really the issue. And you know, we're talking specifically about construction and buildings because it's what we're involved with, but it goes well beyond that.
One other sort of topic that would fit into the beyond lead category is also you know, a lot of people in the environmental movement also try to tie into sort of a social justice movement. And, you know, that might seem like it's just a bunch of left-wing people, you know.
Are we going political?
conflating, you know, different political ideas together. But, you know, in reality, it actually has a very, social justice has a concrete and direct relationship to the environment and vice versa. And the way I would explain it is that it's pretty well known that basically the poorer a country is, the higher the rate of population expansion in that country. There's one really notable exception, which is China, which has a political system which inhibits that. But you know, basically there is a direct correlation between poverty and population growth. And population growth obviously has a real impact on the environment. So you ideally want to get to a point where people have, you know, enough to be secure, and countries are wealthy enough. You know, when you keep people in poverty, there is a cost to really everyone. And
establishing the sort of social culture of conservation as well. And social, you know, meaning that the way the society works as a whole has sustainability as a fairly significant aspect. Well, since we've pretty much gone well beyond construction here, I want to thank everybody for tuning in, and we'll see you next time on Architecture Talk.
Thank you for listening. This has been Kevin Schellenbach with Architecture Talk and my special guest. Please leave any comments at archtalk, ARCHTALK, @gmail.com. Thanks for listening. Picture.